So nice to see you, Matt.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the reasons you decided to take this job is because you're really interested in public engagement in ethical questions. And you say CU has a big emphasis on doing just that. The university recently finished construction of the new Fulgenetti Center, which houses the Center for Bioethics. And it includes a sort of theater in the round, the Fulgenetti Pavilion. You have some ideas about using that pavilion to engage the public. Talk about some of those ideas.
Sure. I have a dream, and we'll see whether we can make this dream a reality. The dream is to, in a way, recreate an experience that I had as a child watching a PBS program, which was the Fred Friendly seminar series. And what Fred Friendly would do, he was a journalist, and he would bring together experts from around the country and set them up as sort of a panel. And then he would assign them roles in a role play where he would say, you know, okay, you're going to be Dr. X, and Dr. X, Mrs. Jones here is your patient, and Mrs. Jones has the following problem. Dr. X, what would you say to Mrs. Jones? And then Mrs. Jones, you know, how would you respond to Dr. X? And then the case would become increasingly more complicated, and he would bring in specialists, or he would bring in policymakers and say, okay, so Dr. Jones has just proposed using this drug, which costs this much money and provides this much benefit to Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones would like to take that drug. Mr. Phillips here, you're the executive at the insurance company. Are you going to be willing to pay for that? And these conversations were so engaging because they were a narrative sort of story. And I would love to recreate some of those in this Fulgenetti Pavilion, which that was the first thing I noticed when I walked into it, was this would be a terrific environment for that kind of a conversation. It is truly a forum in the sense that it is designed for interchange. So that's what I would like to see happen.
Why do you think it's so important to engage the public in these questions? Why can't you just do it by bringing together the various colleges of pharmacy and nursing and, you know, the medical students and so forth?
Yeah, these are the types of questions that are not purely scientific or technical in nature. The questions that we're talking about are policy questions. They have often a heavy technical or expertise base in terms of understanding the question. But in terms of resolving it, you start to get into issues of values and issues of priorities. And when you're talking about values and priorities, those are things that the public and, you know, general people without any particular scientific or medical expertise, they have equal expertise with regard to what's important in their lives. And so often they have greater expertise in terms of what's important in their lives. So when you're talking about policy issues, you really have to bring the public into the conversation.
One of your big issues is about how to create the best healthcare teams. Talk about why this is such a challenge.
In the past, I think there's been a common conceptualization of the medical encounter as being, you know, one doctor, one patient. They come together for 15 minutes or more or less, and then the patient goes home and takes care of themselves until the next time they come back to see the doctor. The evolving reality of the healthcare system, though, is that we're dealing with patients who have chronic conditions, who need support in self-management beyond the doors of our clinics. And when they come into our clinics, they often need more than just the technical expertise of one type of clinician. They will often need someone to help them with their interchange with the pharmacy, for example, or they will need someone to help them with social issues, rent, legal issues. And so figuring out what the proper configuration is for a healthcare team moving forward is one of the major challenges in the healthcare system today.
I mean, that sounds kind of like an organizational issue. It doesn't sound like it's necessarily an ethical issue. How does that play into it?
Right. So the reason this becomes an ethical issue is because it pits certain values in tension with each other. So there is, for example, the issue of confidentiality. When a patient comes to see an individual doctor, it's pretty clear that what you're talking about together can stay within that room in the traditional, conceptualization. Now, moving forward, and in fact, this is true right now today, a lot when I type information from that encounter into my electronic medical record, it's no longer just information that's shared between the two of us. Now that information is available to everyone else with access to that electronic record. And there have been small studies that have shown that on average, there might be 70 or 80 people who will access that record over the course of, say, a hospitalization.
70 or 80 people.
Yeah. So when you are having an interchange with a doctor, you know, you have to be able not only to trust that doctor with your information, you have to be able to trust the entire team of people who may then have access to your information because they're involved in your care. And you want them to have access to that information. If you think about it, it makes sense. You need the pharmacy team to be able to know what that information says because, you know, heaven forbid the doctor doesn't recognize that you have an allergy because it's not in the right place in the chart, for example, but the pharmacist notices the allergy. The pharmacist needs to have access to that information in order to call the doctor and say, you know, you prescribed Bactrim, that's a sulfa drug. This patient shouldn't receive a sulfa drug. So we have a need for coordination of care for all the members of the team to see the information, but it puts the traditional notions of confidentiality under some tension sometimes.
And then there's also the question of how much power the patient or the patient's family has. And you've talked about this, written about this, whether medicine should be seen as sort of a consumer force. Hi, doctor, I know exactly what I need. I need this MRI right now, or I need this drug right now.
Yeah.
So how much power should a patient have as a quote-unquote member of that team?
Yeah, this is one of the most challenging dilemmas that we're facing now because medicine has never been a sort of the customer is always right type of business. And that stems in part from the fact that medicine is highly complex and technical, and it's not really feasible for most patients to become technical experts in their own care. It's also the case, and this is a little contentious, but it's also the case that patients are very invested in their own situation. And there's a saying that, you know, a doctor who treats himself as a patient it has both a fool for a patient and a fool for a doctor. And the same is sometimes true for individuals. You know, we have preferences and values that really need to come into play in making medical decisions. And we should have a great deal of influence in what type of treatment we receive. But we are not ordering, you know, off of a menu at a restaurant. We're dealing with you know, situations that are much more complex than that. So if every patient who came to me asking for, you know, a prescription for narcotics, if I just said, well, how many do you need? And wrote that out, I would be neglecting my role as their, you know, helper. I would also be neglecting my social role. The reason that, you know, only certain groups of people who've been trained and socialized into this profession have the right to make those prescriptions is because we agree to take on this social role of ensuring that people don't abuse these drugs. So it's tough because we really do want to see more shared decision making. We want to see patients engaged in self-care. We want patients to know a lot about the conditions that they have and how to manage those conditions. And at the same time, there's a reason why you go to a doctor and don't just self-treat.
How much should doctors consider the issue of cost when you're saying, gosh, you know, should we do this expensive treatment for this one patient or is it just too expensive?
Yeah, the question of whether physicians or any other direct care provider should be considering cost is one that's been raised a lot in the last several years. And it's a complex issue because on the one hand, the simplest answer is, well, if the cost bears on that particular patient, then absolutely you should be considering cost because that patient is affected by the cost. And so you're really not saying any other things beyond that patient's best interests are lying behind your decision making.
I have a very high deductible plan. I've got to decide, do I do
exactly.
surgery or physical therapy?
So it matters to you, what the cost is of the treatment. And so I, as your doctor, should talk to you about that, and we should make a shared decision that takes into account the cost of the treatment to you. The more contentious issue is, what if the cost doesn't hit you that much, but it hits the insurance pool a lot? So insurance is a way of pooling resources, right? So there are thousands of people who all pay premiums, or their employer pays premiums on their behalf. They put those premiums together, and every time I then write a prescription as a doctor for a patient who needs that medicine, the payment for that medicine comes out of that shared pool. So anytime I write a prescription for a patient who has insurance, I am, in effect, spending someone else's money. And that's fair enough. I have the responsibility to do that. That's my job, is to decide how best to spend that shared pool of resources to give every patient the best opportunity for the best health outcome. But it does mean that I've got to now pay a little bit of attention to whether I'm draining that pool on behalf of, you know, my patients, and then the doctor next door or the next patient in line is not going to be able to access that money, or the prices are going to have to go up. And this, of course, is what we've been seeing for decades now, is rapidly rising prices throughout healthcare. And a lot of people blame some of those rapid rises in healthcare on physicians and patients who don't recognize the cost of the decisions that they're making because they're shielded.
Lots of testing, lots of expensive treatments because they exist.
Because they exist, and in part because they are paid for by the insurance plan. And so people feel like, I've paid my money into the insurance, I want to get as much out of it as I can. I do want to say there's a limit to that. I have never yet met a patient who wanted more than one colonoscopy. So this is not like Coca-Cola, right? Most of what we do in medicine, people don't want more of it.
Mm-hmm.
They want less of it.
Right.
The main goal of most people who are in the hospital is to spend as few days in the hospital as they possibly can. So we're not talking about a traditional, you know, typical consumer good. But there is a sort of supply-demand curve in medicine, as the economists would say. And if you reduce the cost to the individual patient by covering some portion of it through insurance, then there's a lower threshold for people to say, yeah, sure, why not get that? It's covered by insurance.
There's a whole other side to this institute, and that's the medical humanities piece. For listeners who aren't familiar with that term, define what medical humanities is.
Sure. So medical humanities is the study and practice of bringing humanism and humanities studies like philosophy, but also things like art and literature into the medical encounter and into contemplation of medical issues. So medical humanities blends very nicely with the idea we were talking about before of bringing the public into these conversations. So I'll give you an example. One of the ways that we commonly now teach about the patient-doctor relationship is by having students read a novel. And a novel is, you know, not the same as reading a textbook. It can give you insight into how people are thinking, the ways in which they construct the stories that lead them to have made certain decisions.
So what's a common novel or a short story that professors often use to teach medical students this stuff?
Oh, there are some classics. The ones that I've used myself include The Death of Ivan Ilyich, which is a Tolstoy novel. Another is The Use of Force, which is a terrific short story by a physician writer, a guy named William Carlos Williams from the, you know, the last century.
Poet.
Yes, the poet. And he describes in just a few pages a really intense scene with a young girl who does not want him to examine her throat because she knows already that she has diphtheria. And in that era, diphtheria was a death sentence. And he ends up having to pry her mouth open, you know, with splintering of the tongue depressor and so on, in order to see the evidence of diphtheria in the back of her throat. And it's a terrific way to get people talking about paternalism and the idea of, you know, forcing a patient into something which the patient doesn't want to do? And is that ever justified? And what is the impact of that on the physician? So it leads to all kinds of terrific conversation. So we can watch a movie and have a conversation about that. We can look at art, a painting, for example. There's a terrific program that's at the Anschutz campus right now in the Fulgenetti Pavilion, where there is an art gallery. The art gallery right now has a display called the Joe Bonham Project, We Are Not Our Wounds. These are art pieces by veterans and about veterans who've been injured during the war. This type of experiential learning is really different from learning in from a textbook or even from a lecture, and yet it is central to learning what it means and how to act as a physician or, for that matter, as a patient.
And I should say that this is a traveling exhibit. It took place at the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington.
Correct.
And they're really remarkable, quick sketches almost, in some cases, of these soldiers who came back and are amputees or, you know, still being treated and hooked up to IVs. And it's
very powerful. And often, you know, the sketch or the drawing will be associated with a vignette, so that you know a little about what was happening and why and what has happened subsequently. So it's a very nice blending of narrative art, storytelling, and art as a, you know, sketching or portraiture, that kind of thing.
Have you heard any reactions from any medical students, other students on campus to this?
So right outside the gallery, there is a board where people can put up their reactions on, you know, slips of paper. And so I did look through those the other day, and it is remarkable. The common theme, of course, is people putting together the sort of, again, the technical, like, oh, I've seen this happen, this procedure, for example, and it never dawned on me what the impact of that would be on, you know, the individual going through it as a patient. That's a pretty common experience, actually, for folks in medical school to gradually move, you know, from being a person to being a doctor. We spend so much time on the science and the skills, the technical skills of, you know, learning to do this or that. And much of that comes with some degree of distancing, because if you think about it too much, it's really difficult to put a scalpel to a person. So there has to be some degree of distancing that occurs. The humanities programs are ways to maintain that connection with the human side of what it means to be involved in the healthcare system while becoming a healthcare professional.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.